Okay, then let's move on to Rava Vadia. I wrote, some of you might have seen my essay in the Oro Journal, which I'll use some of this and present other ideas on Rav Avadia. Outstanding rabbinic figures, this is how I began my essay, do not usually merit biographies written about them in their lifetime, and usually have people like me looking for in a graduate program, looking for a subject, and you're given a topic, and you write about them. There hasn't been a book written about Rav Chaim Moser, there hasn't been a book written by Rav Moshe, there hasn't been a book written about Rav Herzog. We saw a book that was edited. Yes, there have been art scroll books, but I'm talking about serious academic. There have been some articles. With Rav Avadia, just in the last couple of years, you have three volumes. I'm holding a few of them. The best one of them is this Maran, written by two journalists. Then you have another book, Ben Parat Yosef, and then you have a work, Mimaran on Maran, that's from the Shulchan Aruch to Rav Avadia Yosef, written by Rav Bini Lau, an up-and-coming rabbi in Israel. I don't know if he's been to Toronto yet, but he's certainly a very popular one. There's another book came out a couple of years ago that focuses on who the man regards as the two most important people in Israel who are paradigmatic of the two most important. One is Rav Avadia, who represents Torah, and there's no question he's the most important rabbi in Israel. He's the most important rabbi in the world, but certainly in Israel you see that. And the other was Aaron Barak, who represents liberal, democratic, the Western ethos. And these two men represent the two Israels. And just 2 weeks ago, a new book came out by Ariel Picard, another study of Rav Avadia Yosef's halachic method, and there'll be more and more written about him because his significance and his influence is unlike any rabbi we have today, and unlike any rabbi in hundreds of years, as we'll see. And his influence continues. So already we see the name of the new book, I forgot. Email me, because I had Beagle Eyes, and I told him to get me a copy. It's published by Bar-Ilan University Press. It was his doctoral dissertation. I can't recall the name at present. And there are other dissertations about Rav Avadia, which will be coming out soon in book forms. Already you're dealing with someone in his lifetime is the subject of five real books, a number of dissertations, and hundreds and hundreds of articles. So obviously this is someone very special, as we will see. What is it about Rav Avadia, though, that makes him so significant? Some American Orthodox don't even get the sense of who he is. The answer is not simple, and it comes down to a combination of the religious and the political. Had Rav Avadia not entered politics in 1983, his term as chief rabbi was up. He wanted to continue being chief rabbi, and he was kicked out. Truthfully, it was revenge. He came in 1973 and kicked out his predecessor, Yitzhak Nissim. Now, Yitzhak Nissim has a powerful son named Moshe Nissim, who was important in Likud circles. He was a minister in the government. And when it came time for Rav Avadia's term, they have a 10-year term, to be up, but he wanted to continue it, and Moshe Nissim was influential in getting rid of him and putting in his adversary, who we'll speak about, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. And today you now have four people who go by the title Rishon LeZion. This, we spoke about what the Rishon LeZion is. It's been for about 300 years now, or 250 years, we've had Sephardic figures who've been officially known as the chief rabbis. This was established under the Ottoman Empire. There's Rav Avadia, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Eliyahu Bakshi Doron, and Rav Shlomo Amar, who's the current one, who Rav Avadia recently declared him as his successor. Had he not gone into politics, you're right, it's like multiple boxing holders with the World Boxing Association, World Boxing Council, they're all called Maran, Harishon Lezion, Harav Rashi Yisrael, but Amar and Bakshi Doron are students, are followers of Rav Avadia, so they regard themselves as second-rate compared to him. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu regards him as their equal, and that's and we'll see about some of their controversies today. Had he not gone into politics with the Shas party, he certainly would have had a lower profile, while his influence in religious circles would have been great. In fact, it probably would have been greater because his image was really hurt by his foray into politics. He would not have had the wide significance he currently has. He is the only rabbi whom every Israeli knows who he is. You show any Israeli the picture, they'll know who he is. He's that significant. Now, two of these books I showed you before are complete biographies, written by religious people, incidentally. one of them is written by a rabbi and someone else, and, you know, they're, and the other, I believe, they're also both religious. And they show the complexity of the man. If any of you are interested to read Hebrew, I recommend them highly. If you like this sort of stuff, one of them in particular, the book called Maran, this one is a real page-turner. He has become now, he has come from very humble beginnings, as I'll speak about in a few minutes, to not only the world's most important rabbi, but also he is the power, religious power broker in Israel. I pointed out one interesting thing in the my article on them, which I'll repeat now, that it's really refreshing reading these books because they take us back to a much more innocent era. We are now in an era when you have rabbis declaring things like that it's usher to even go into a Starbucks and get a coffee there unless the whole rest Starbucks is under hashkacha, you know, that sort of thing. And you read about how Rav Avadia would take his students to the coffee houses in Cairo, and Rav Avadia happens to be a great lover of Arabic music. Maybe he got it there. So you get taken back to a more innocent era, and reading Rav Avadia's Tshuvot, we'll talk about some, and he says things which just blow you away, which are unimaginable in today's day and age, but he sort of doesn't know what the Orthodox view is today. He's not really in Orthodoxy, as we'll see with the Sephardic rabbis. He's simply a Torah Jew, so he's a little bit behind the times in knowing what's acceptable and what's not. So I find that very interesting. Now, a feeling, when you read these books, you get a feeling that he's a paradoxical man. On the other hand, his knowledge, the sheer knowledge, is unlike anyone else today, unlike anyone else in history, as far as I know. No, he's not exactly politically correct, and we'll see some examples, for good and for bad. Some of the things we'll see, he's not politically correct. It's very unfortunate that he's not. But at other times, it's great that he's not politically correct. You take the good and the bad. None of the other rabbinic authorities in our time even come close to him in terms of sheer knowledge. Those who know Hebrew, and you're going to say I'm exaggerating, people said to me, because I gave this talk and I wrote the essay, they said, well, Geshem Sholem knew a lot too, and what about this Rav and that Rav? And all I can say is take out his Yaviyah Omer. There's nothing like it. And that's also to be the problem. But thousands of sources in every tshuva from left and right, all in his head, no CD-ROMs, none of this stuff. It is incredible. I've never seen anything like it. And anyone who reads Hebrew, take a look at some of these works of his. Even Saul Lieberman, because Saul Lieberman knew backwards and forwards, but Saul Lieberman spent his time on important stuff, on Shas, and on the major authorities, and on Greek literature, and all that. Had Saul Lieberman spent his time reading the most obscure, insignificant Achronim, maybe he would have known it too. Maybe he was just as brilliant. But in terms of sheer knowledge, Rav Moshe Feinstein also had a great memory. If he spent his time reading, but Rav Avadia hasn't gone through Shas as many times as Lieberman. Lieberman maybe went through it 1,000 times. Maybe Rav Avadia only went through it 200 times. And all the other times, he's reading all these sources. So it's just in terms of sheer amount of knowledge, which doesn't make you the greatest. We'll see the Ashkenazic criticism in a few minutes. But since the rugged shover, I don't know of any mind like that. In fact, I would go farther and say that how can you take seriously a so-called chief rabbinate in the state of Israel in which Rav Avadia doesn't have the top position? And as mentioned above, he has no yichus. He's not like all these other big rabbis that marry into each other's families and have yichus. He comes from the most humble of beginnings. And throughout his career, he's shown great courage and compassion, no question about it, and you can't take this away from him. For example, he was in Egypt. He was confronted with community leaders in Egypt. They had a community old age homes in which they didn't keep kosher there, and he fought against them. You had shochetim there who were not reliable, and the chief rabbi there and the other dayanim wouldn't stand up against them. Rav Avadia stood up against them, so much so that one of these families of shochetim attacked him with a bottle of acid, threw it in his face. It turns out it wasn't Rav Avadia. They hired some thugs, and coming out of Rav Avadia's house or office, you get the details in both of the books, they threw it at the wrong person. And Rav Avadia speaks about this also in one of his tshuvot. So he was courageous. He refused to stop preaching about the land of Israel, even though this was in the year of and after the 1948 war, when that was regarded as not being a traitor by the Egyptian government. So He showed great courage, no question about it. He came about his humble beginnings. His father was a simple man. If all was going according to plan, he would have joined his father at age 11 in his father's little store. But the yeshiva convinced his father to allow him to remain in yeshiva. But there's no yichus there. He's not an aristocrat from the aristocracy. He doesn't come from the elite. He comes from the lowest sectors of Baghdadi Jewry. Unlike Rav Nissim, who and the others we'll speak about, who came from the upper crust, who were elites. You have the Sassoon families and others. He was a young upstart, and that probably is what enabled him to do what he did, as we'll see in a minute, going up against all these aristocratic Baghdadi figures. In addition, right after the Yom Kippur War, it's famous. This really cemented his reputation. You had all these agunas. You had these women whose husbands didn't come back, but we don't have the body. About 500 of them. And he took these, and over 6 months, he went over him, and he convened a Beis Din, painstakingly going over the files of all these missing in action people, and not one aguna was left after he was finished with them. You had the Israelis who were killed, who were behind enemy lines. They just buried them there. Or they were shot down. They just, who knows what happened to them. Not one aguna was left after that. And that really cemented his reputation. Those who know Rav Avadia know him as an honorable man, a loyal man, who is willing to go up against everyone in the name of his truth, and he suffered for it. The paradox, however, is the man who spends all of his day studying Shas and Poskim and devoted to the most advanced levels of Torah study has also shown a side, and this I think answers what Effie's speaking about, more reflective of the low culture of his youth. Now, there is a positive side to this. No other Sephardic scholar was able to connect with the masses. From his teenage years, when he began to give shiurim, he achieved the following. The masses loved him. He was always butting heads with the rabbinic leaders, but the masses loved him, and that was his strength, and that would remain his strength in forming the Shas party. And if you've never been to his classes, you can watch his classes now online. Because when he got sick in the last year, he no longer does it from the old Bukharan shul, so you don't see you can listen to his shiurim every week, Motzei Shabbos. They're archived, maran1.com. I forgot who has maran.com, but go to maran1.com and you can watch his shiurim. I find them actually very difficult to understand, not like Rav Mordechai Yahu, because unless you grew up in Israel, or I guess you speak it better than me, the Arabic accent is so hard, you really need to listen to it. I guess if you listen to it enough, you get used to it. Rav Mordechai Yahu, you can also listen to him at harav.org, but he doesn't have the same deep Arabic accent. But when I was in Israel in 1984-85, I went to the Bukharan synagogue to listen to Rav Avadia, and you get a sense, he's throwing in the Arabic terms, the Arabic, Arabic they told me was Arabic curse words and phrases and everything. He divides the shiur into halacha, and then he tells stories, so you get a sense of how he can relate to the masses, and he has a gift for that, no question about it. He's from Iraqi. I mean, he comes from there, and then early on he came to Israel. He went to Egypt when he was sent by his yeshiva because they needed a dayan in the 1940s. And he sees himself as also as part of the Egyptian tradition now. Together with this, though, Rav Avadia has been known for numerous outrageous statements. Just plug his name, Google Rav Avadia, outrageous statements, and you'll come up with a whole load of them. In a way that no other gadol has ever done. You have gadolim who say occasionally a crazy thing, but Rav Avadia, it's a pattern. You can almost bet on it. It's consistent. You have people who go to secular reporters used to go to his classes, and now they watch him online, just waiting for the next doozy that's going to come out. His cursing out of this or that politician, and he didn't care, left wing, right wing. He actually was very friendly with Perez. They've had a friendship for many years, so he would make a habit of cursing out Shamir, cursing out Sharon, cursing out the Supreme Court justices, using really harsh language from the gutter, calling them Boalei Midot and all sorts of terrible things, eaters of swine. I mean, really yeshivish type of language. In addition to promising heavenly rewards for those who voted for his political party, And as I said, they wait for the next juicy quote. The most embarrassing, perhaps, I'm sure you all remember this, was after the Katrina episode, we consider in America embarrassing, and he earned the condemnation of the ADL for this, in addition to other things. But you can go to the website, myron1.com, and just look a few things down on the homepage. It'll say there, the link will say Maron's words about the hurricane and the evacuation from Gush Katif. And if you click on that, you get the thing which created the outrage is still there on the website. You can listen to it. What does he say on this? Well, why was there Hurricane Katrina? It was in retribution for the Bush administration's support of the evacuation from Gaza. Why not? I don't know what you make of this in terms of theology. Why are the innocent people being published? But he had an answer for it. And why did it happen in New Orleans? Because that's where the blacks live, and blacks don't study Torah. So they're, now granted, the people, truthfully, it's wrong. Out of all the, down there in the South, they're big Bible, it's a Bible belt. But, I mean, and the outcry was incredible. Leaving aside, how does any human then declare how these things happen, become a prophet? But the offense, you know, where people were dying, had recently died, it was very offensive, no question about it. I'll get to the corruption in the middle. And we call this person a gadol despite that. I believe, I'll say it now and I'll repeat it, you have to separate. You have to say Torah lachud, politics lachud, as the Gemara would say. If you don't separate it, no one's going to remember these statements, I don't think, years from now. You have to, it's a problem. Hold off on that question, because when we speak about his foray into politics, where we see also real problems, then we have to raise, you raise a good question, Effie. Do you regard such a person as a gadol? My approach is that you have to separate the politics and the statements from the Torah. Obviously, there reaches a point where you could say it's just too much. But hold off on this, and we'll come back to this question. But in the last, he has lost a lot of his status. Hatsofer attacked him very harshly just about a month ago. Why? Because he made outrageous comments about Mordechai Eliyahu, his predecessor, and also a great sage who himself has made outrageous statements. He recently said that in the Holocaust was because of the Reform Jews and all this, and he prophesied. And I have it's probably not on the website anymore, but I can send it to anyone because I copied it because I knew they'd be taking this down. He prophesied, and he said it was a nevuah. And asked on his website, is this really a nevuah? He prophesied that there would never be the Hiknat Kut. And they asked, is this a prophecy? And the answer given on his website, it is a real prophecy, and God will not make Rav Mordechai look like a fool. Well, of course, there was the Hiknat Kut. I'm sure many of you remember this prophecy, and I can, like I said, I can send it to you. So he's made his share of statements. But Rav Avadia said just about a month ago that he's an Am Haaretz, that he has pretenses of being a rabbi, he's a phony rabbi, and of course, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is one of the leading rabbonim of the Mafdal, which is the Hatzofek crowd, so they attacked Rav Avadya Yosef in a way that never would have been unimaginable before this, showing that they don't regard him as a gadol anymore. It was a sarcastic essay, an editorial in which they said, Rav Avadya, we hear it reported what you stated, and you can see it, he actually wrote it, but they said, we don't believe you really wrote this, because no gadol would ever write this. Anyone who would write this is simply a boor, B-O-O-R, and an uncouth person. And since we know that you're a gadol, you never could have said this about Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. And this was covered by all the Israeli papers. Anyone interested, I can send you the links. And just last month, a month or 2 months ago, he attacked the Moroccans. The major electoral support for the Shas party are the Moroccans. And his successor, Amar, is a Moroccan, and he said, Dad, you can't pay attention to all these Moroccan men hugging, basically these are ignorant people from Morocco. So he speaks off the cuff, no question about it. And there are plenty of similar examples that show we're not dealing with someone who occasionally misspeaks, as we all do. And both of these biographies have chapters, detail, describing all this. Yes, send me the links, I'll give it to you. We're not dealing with someone who misspeaks. We're dealing with a basic facet of a Rav Avadya's personality, or some might say personalities, because I don't know how to make the two coexist, to synthesize the personality who has such avos yisrael. I mean, here's a man who works hard for the non-religious, tries to bring peace and all these sorts of things, and who soars the heights of Torah with one who, you know, could still speak this way. I mean, the stories I know from people who were involved firsthand. Just to give you one story, this girl comes from a secular Israeli family. I shouldn't say secular, Sephardic Israeli family, and her parents started becoming more religious. Her father became a chassid of Rav Avadia, you know, going to his classes and all that, but the girl wasn't really religious, and she became pregnant, not married, and she had the baby, and she was terrified to tell her father, you know, what's the reason, you know. And one of the chaplains in the hospital put her in touch with this other rabbi, actually Rabbi Lone, from Yeshiva HaKotel. I believe it was the chaplain or Rav Elon himself, or the nurse put him in touch, and he went in to speak to Maran, you know, Rav Avadia, and told him the story about this, that the girl, you know, her father's going to reject her, and I heard this from Rav Elon himself spoke about this. So Rav Avadia, and he calls up, he has his secretary call up this man before Rosh Hashanah. This was right before Rosh Hashanah, when, of course, the man Rav Avadia has so much to do, and says that Rav Avadia, Maran wants to meet with you. Now, this is like someone being called up and say, the president wants you to come to the White House tomorrow, and it's even more for someone like this, a typical Sephardi who's become a Baal Tshuva, who's a Chassid Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia wants him to come to his house. No explanation. So he comes to Rav Avadia's house, and Rav Avadia is there with Rav Elon, and he has some schnapps there and some cake, and he says, we're making l'chaim. And the guy says, why are we making a chayim? I'm giving you a mazel tov on the birth of your daughter. I want you now to go and greet her, to see your new grandson, and, you know, welcome into your family. It's, you know, and that was it. And then, of course, when Maran says this, so for someone like, there's other Gedolim, I don't want to say their names because it's Lashon Hara, they don't have time for things like that. They don't have time for the average person. They don't have time for the non-religious girl who, gets pregnant. They don't have time. I mean, it's a very different type of personality, and it's a person who, as I said, all the Sephardim look up to him, non-religious as well. And yet this was the man who brought Shas into a labor merits government in the 1990s, a government which was set on peace, a government, you know, the Rabin government, later others took over, obviously, after Rabin was killed, and you can read the eulogy of Rav Avadia for Yitzhak Rabin. I've seen eulogies from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Roshama Avinev. Does Rav Yashin write a eulogy for Yitzhak Rabin? Of course not. Yitzhak Rabin, he shouldn't have been killed, but he's a Mechal HaShabbos. He's an Ochlein of Elos HaTreifos. So they have no time for people like Yitzhak Rabin. And the fact that he was killed shows that the problems of religious Zionism. Who else would write a eulogy? You have to read what Rav Avadia writes about Yitzhak Rabin, trying to the best of his ability to do what's good for the Jewish people. So you see a real sensitive side for him. Now I'll get to that in a second. You're right. And he has this side on the, until the Gush Katif. I'll speak about it probably next class, how to square his liberal view on giving back land, which is strong opposition to Gush Katif. You're right, coming from the masses cuts both ways. Uncouth lingo, he doesn't seem to understand the way he speaks, you know, how it offends people, and the ability to connect. The same man, though, who brought them into the labor merits government, and this brought down the wrath of the Haredim. I mean, labor merits, who's more anti-religious than merits? From a Avadia standpoint, what's the difference? Shamir is a Mechal HaShabbos, Ochlein of Elos and Treifos, what's the difference in him and Yossi Sarid? So he brought him into this government, and yet he soon turned against them. He referred to Sarid as Haman, stating that God will uproot him just like he uproots Amalek. I mean, using language like this. And the same one who's spoken so eloquently in favor of territorial compromise, who's gone to see Mubarak, who went as an emissary of Shimon Peres, with whom he's been friends with for 30 years. They used to learn Gemara once a month. He's gone to Mubarak. He's spoken to other Arab leaders. This is the same one who another time referred to the Arabs, all Arabs, you know, speaking generalities, as snakes. So, and there was even a plot. They discovered a plot of terrorists to assassinate Rav Avadia. So, what to make of this? He's obviously a very complicated figure. And as I said, you can see the good discussions in both of these biographies by reporters in Israel who do the religion beat. Just like we have in America, you know, the religion beat. You have people who focus, who their beat is the Haredim. The Haredim world is so interesting that you focus on it. These, I'll tell you incidentally, though, these are not Haredi historiographies. First of all, they quote from Rav Avadia's unpublished diaries. And when I asked one of the reporters how he got them, he wouldn't tell me, but the answer is obvious. Rav Avadia cooperated with them. And they discuss all these things, his controversies. They discuss the problem with his sons. His son, he has a son, Rav Yaakov, who has abandoned his father. They probably aren't even on speaking terms, at least for many years they weren't. He's joined with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, and he's one of his rabbis. He's in the religious Zionist camp, and he's a big opponent of Shas. So, and they discuss this whole machlokes between father and son. You know, he's the eldest son, maybe the greatest of all the sons. So it's been a very, he's had a very difficult relationship with one of the sons. All the other sons have all fallen into line. They all have yeshivas and kolels, etc. In the unpublished diaries, you have incredible stuff. And for example, attacks on Rav Kaduri. Who's Rav Kaduri? Rav Kaduri is the famous Kabbalist who later becomes an important part of the Shas machine, giving out amulets, appearing with them at meetings, the Iraqi Kabbalist. But in the early years, Rav Kaduri banned Rav Avadia from his shul because of the machokas I'll speak about. And Rav Avadia, although he later recognized Rav Kaduri as a great makubal and even to this day speaks at the memorials and put him on the dais, he allowed the reporters to publish things from his diary, basically calling Rav Kaduri an Amaretz who tries to dabble in Kabbalah. It's as if Rav Avadia wants the world to know that he's an Ish Halacha, he's a halachic man, and the only reason he did all these things with the amulets was because he needed to get his party elected so they could build mikvahs and schools and all that. But he wants the world to know for posterity what appears in his diary, because he didn't have to show them these diaries from the 50s. But even after he made up, as it were, with Rav Kaduri and gave him kavod, you can see in the diaries that he thinks he's basically a fraud. He allows the reporters in both books to publish things, what he says about Rav Yitzchak Nissim, his predecessor, all sorts of Lashon Hara. Of course, from a Avadia standpoint, it's not Lashon Hara, because Rav Nissim deserved it. But they battled, and he has about 8 children. He has a Rav Moshe, a Rav Yitzchak, a Rav David. He has a few girls. One of his girls went off the derech. She married a religious Hezder boy. And there's another girl who has a, who's head of this institute now to give the Haredi women secular education, which is now banned by them. But they all pretty much follow him, and they're big time nechachamim. The Yalkut Yosef, or Yitzhak Yosef, is written in the same style, Rav David Yosef. Now, in seeking to understand Rav Avadia, who, as I said, not since Rav Yaakov Emden do we get someone so complicated. I mean, the Sri Yesh was complicated, but I think sometimes I think Rav Avadia is even more complicated. This gets to the question of Effie. You can view him in his totality, or you can completely separate his halachic achievement from his political persona. And the new book by Bini Lau, Mi Maran on Maran, separates the two. And in the review I saw in Haaretz, they're very critical of this, but I don't know. Look, if you can do, for example, an essay on the Rambam and not talk about his various machlokot. Obviously, in a biography, you have to include everything. But I do believe that you can take his scholarship and let it stand on its own. Thankfully, future generations are not going to remember his curses of this politician or that. Does anyone here remember the way the Rambam cursed out the people he didn't like? You can read it in the letters, but that's not what we think of. And I think similarly with Rav Avadia, we're not going to remember that. We're going to remember his halachic writings, and especially, I think, politically, it's very important. If you're a right-winger, Rav Avadia then becomes puzzle in your eyes, because he believes in political territorial compromise and all that. And if we're going to start evaluating our great sages by political litmus tests, then Ein L'Dav Arsof, then Rav Avadia, that's what the Haredim do, and that's the problem with them. You're going to say Rav Avadia's puzzle, because you're going to say Rav Soloveitchik's puzzle, because he believed in territorial compromise, you're going to go the other way. I think you just have to look at them as great Torah scholars, therefore you can take the Satmar Rav for his Torah and throw out all the other stuff we spoke about last class. Otherwise, like I said, Ein L'Dav Arsof, we're going to have to constantly be determining, does this person's hashkafas, do they work for us? And I don't think that's the proper thing to do. Yes, and rabbinic rhetoric is always fun. Now, since Rav Avadia has taken positions in opposition to the Haredim, it's not surprising that he has been a focus of their anger. Much of this has to do with his political positions as well as Shas, which we'll talk about next class. Shas is now the leading, what we call fervently Orthodox, or Haredi, they're not exactly Ashkenazi Haredi, but they're certainly Haredi political party. And when we see how this came about and what Rav Avadia did, how he turned on his masters, we'll see the anger. Now, when he was affiliated with the Ashkenazi Haredim, as he was in the 1980s, their newspapers referred to him as Maran, gave him all the kavod in the world. When he parted with them, he became persona non grata, and all sorts of attacks on him were regarded as permissible. And that there's been a little bit of lessening recently, but I mean, pretty much Rav Avadia Yosef is not regarded as a repository of Das Torah. So anyone who follows him is not following Das Torah, of course. The whole notion, why can't Rav Avadia have his Das Torah? But all sorts of attacks. Yeah, he's no Uncle Tom. Now, it wasn't only his political outlook. His halachic outlook also. For example, I mentioned before the Yom Kippur War, the way he freed all the Agunas. He set forth his ruling in a long tshuva, which cites probably 1,000 sources, and this has now become a standard work for poskim who want to deal with Aguna issues. The Haredi world would have none of it. In a recent book, in a recent book published of the Stipor's writings, it discusses this episode, and Rav Avadia isn't even given an R before his name. He's just called Ovadia. And the Stipor is quoted as saying that he will, quote, rely on a tshuva, even if it's from a book that's not accepted, such as some author from Egypt, or someone similar. I would merely add that for someone like the Stipor and the Ashkenazi Haredi, no author from Egypt, and maybe since the Radbaz's day, or W.M. Zimmer in the 1500s, would ever be acceptable. They are not accepted. You have all sorts of works in the Sephardic canon, which are just not part of the Ashkenazi canon. So we have the halachic approach of Rav Avadia, halachic disagreements, the Heter Mechira, for example, sale of the land, which he still thinks is a permissible thing during Shemitah year, that got the anger against him. But the real issue was not halacha. The real issue was politics. Had Rav Avadia not taken a different political stand than them, his halachic disagreements would have been small matters. They would have disagreed with him, but it wouldn't have been a big issue. They would have given him all the kavod in the world. In the year Shas was established in 1983, really 1982, but Rav Avadia gets on in 1983. It was the brainchild of Rav Shach as a way to bring in, get the Sephardic vote, and get them in a Haredi type of party. And when Rav Avadia came on the scene in 1983, he was the protege. Rav Shach was running the Shas party, and Rav Avadia was doing his bidding. Today, it's funny, you read these attacks of the Haredim on Rav Avadia, and as I said in my essay, it's like a gnat up against an elephant, because Rav Avadia just marches on. What does he care? He has all the power, not them. They reached, in the Labor Merits government, 17 seats in Knesset, the third largest party, and they still have enormous potential. And as I said, he's a religious power broker. And it is quite a success story. We're going to see next class in particular how this happened. In 1992, Rav Shach famously declared that Sephardim were not ready to lead. This was a straw that broke the camel's back that convinced Rav Avadia he has to go out on their own. But from 1983 to 92, Rav Shach is running the Shas party, which is pulling in major numbers. I mean, it becomes the largest of the Haredi parties, and Rav Shach is telling his followers, including the Ashkenazi Haredim, vote for the Shas party, but they're pretty much 95% of the voters, other than Rav Shach's Talmidim, are the Sephardim. In fact, there were some years where they were only Sephardim because he told his followers to vote for Degel Torah, and the Hasidim voted for Agudas Yisrael, and Rav Shach is in control. And, of course, the Sephardim are biting and chewing at the bit, as they say. When are the Sephardim going to take over? It's the Sephardic party. Why can't the Sephardim run the show? Shach does not have 17 seats now. We hear 11. I'm saying at their height in 92 when Rav Avadia broke away, that's when they reached 17 seats, and we'll figure out. They became the ones that made the Labor Merits government. They were the third party. Some are in jail as too, as we'll see. Together with this great success of the Shas party politically came the inevitable financial corruption, and almost every Knesset member has been investigated and they've gone to jail, not just Aryeh Deri, a whole lot of them. So it's an unfortunate story of what could have been. Rav Shach declared that Sephardim are not ready to lead, that the Ashkenazim have to lead the Sephardim. Now, this comment, which wasn't just out of the blue, this came upon decades of discrimination against Sephardim by the Ashkenazic school system, and it was just the straw that broke the camel's back. So much so that to this year, the Beit Yaakov's Rav Yashi refused to allow them to open on time until every Sephardic girl had a place. If you can believe the newspapers, Rav Yashiv and the Gdolim are against the discrimination, but all the Haredi schools support it, and it's hard to imagine that they could do this without the Gdolim. Rav Yaakov Yosef this year told Sephardic women they can go to court. Do you know what it means to go to Arkos, to go to the secular court, to sue to allow their daughters in, because the Sephardic institution, in fact, in Kiryat Sefer, the Ashkenazic town, they have officially in writing that they only will take 30% Sephardi. You know, there's no Brown versus Board of Education in Israel. These schools have quotas. And they'll tell you, they don't think there's anything wrong with it, that if we have too many Sephardim, it'll change the ethos of the school. We have to keep them under 30%. Haredi neighborhoods, there are certain neighborhoods where you have to have interviews with people to get in. And you have the school systems, and that's the issue. And they have racial profiling. And there was an essay in one of the Orthodox papers just a few weeks ago, I can send the link also, by a woman. She looks Ashkenazic, and she's a Haredi woman, and she spoke about growing up as a person with Sephardi parents, and she's white, light-skinned, so they wouldn't know she's Sephardi and what she'd hear about them. Now, when this comment of Rav Shach came out, this led to enormous identification. Yes, why Mashiach hasn't come, because if Mashiach came and he's wearing kippah sregah, the Haredim would reject him, and vice versa. If he came as a chassid, many non-observant Israelis are used profiling. Yeah, but I would say among the Haredi profile and the Haredi racism is simply the parallel to what went on for all these years among the secular Israelis. The labor governments routinely discriminated against Sephardim. Secular Israeli society also did, so it's nothing new. Listen, if you're a Haredi and you follow the rules, you have no TV, your child gets in, your girl gets into Beis Yaakov. If you're a Sephardi, you have serious problems and it's very difficult. And that's the pattern. And from their perspective, they don't want to have these Sephardi running things. They don't want to have the majority because it's a different ethos. It's not the Haredi Das Torah. They have allegiance to the Sephardic Gedolim, etc. Let me say one more thing before we end. We'll have to take some questions. I'll just say that this comment of Rav Shach created an ethnic identification among the Masoreti Sephardim with Rav Avadia that was unprecedented. Rav Shach's picture was ripped up in development towns across Israel. Shas, which immediately determined that they were going to break from Rav Shach, even though he was the founder of the party, that is, he brought the people in, he organized it, he was the leading light, and he was the spiritual leader. Over those years, Rav Avadia had become the spiritual leader among the Shas party, with the exception of the Sephardic Rosh Yeshiva, who had been educated in Ponevezh and elsewhere. But the Shas party itself, the party regulars, they began plastering Rav Shach's words throughout towns in Israel. They had loudspeakers going through the streets in the development towns over and over playing Rav Shach's comments about them, all in order to stoke the ethnic sentiment, the stoking the fires of anti-Ashkenazic sentiment, which would then become Shas's advantage. Sephardim were proclaiming that they would never again vote for the Ashkenazi Haredim. And when we pick up next class, which will be the last class, we'll see what this led to. Then we'll move into Rav Avadia's halachic method and why I will try to defend my position that he is the most important rabbi, certainly in the Sephardic world since the Shulchan Aruch. And also, I think he's the most significant rabbi, not just in our generation, but for many generations. And then we can discuss that more in detail. And you'll hear, as I said, some incredible halachic decisions, which would be incomprehensible, unimaginable in the orthodoxy of America. It would, as I said, pashmished. You can never get away with these sorts of things. But that's the Rav Avadia. He does what he wants. So any, let's get some questions or comments. Let me move up on, let's see what we got here. Those who are new, we take a few questions, and then we, let's see. Look, Israel's a hard place to live if you're a Haredi. Many Haredim in America, Dafka, don't go to Israel because then they can never go to movies, and they don't want to live in Bnei Brak. We spoke about this last class, Bnei Brak, you're talking about society, no culture, No public libraries, no sports, no music. There's no life for the Haredim in America. When I was in Israel, I saw signs up of Haredim against the Miami Boys Choir. I mean, it's a very no pizza shops. It's a very difficult life. They don't want to live there. Having said that, you take the same sort of people. Obviously, if you're going to be a nonconformist, you're not going to get into the same schools. But there's schools, Haredi light schools, there's other types. The Sfaradim have had it very bad. Now, you say... Rav Shach is a gadol. He said things against Sfaradim, and he said things against Lubavitch. But what makes someone a gadol? A gadol is one who has a large following. You might not like what he says, but he's still a gadol. You might think he's a bad gadol. I mean, bad in the sense that he doesn't serve to be a gadol. But if someone has lots of followings, Rav Shach had enormous following in the yeshiva world, and he did say things against Lubavitch, which many listening here probably would say he was right, what he said. And he said, I will tell you, and when it came to Rav Shach and the Sfaradim, it wasn't really a racist comment, because he wasn't referring to the Sfaradim per se. He was referring to the fact, if you look at the whole context of the quote, that Sfaradim don't have the historical memory, the historical experience of dealing with the non-religious. Therefore, they can't be trusted to know how to properly, relate to them and protect Haredi interests. And some would say he was a prophet, because shortly after that, his comment, when Shas broke away, they formed a labor merits government, and Shalom and Aloni became Minister of Education. So Rav Shach's point always was that you have to go with the right wing. Even though they're not religious, they have more of a sense for religion. Rav Avadia said it doesn't matter if one Mechal Shabbos is no better than another, and can anyone seriously say that Shalom and Aloni and Yossi Sarid are better for religion, or even the same as a secularly Kudnik? That was Rav Shach's point, and Shalom and Aloni got to be so bad they forced her to resign. So you might say Rav Shach was prophetic, that exactly what he was saying, that the Sfaradim don't know how to deal with the non-religious because they never had 150 years of experience. Beit Din. The Rabbi Rachman has a Beis Din. You can just plug it on. I can send you the link. Just plug in Rabbi Rachman's Beis Din, and their job is to free Agunas, and they use the mechanism of Mekachtos, that when the woman married, had she known what type of jerk this guy was, she never would have married him. And how do you know he's a jerk? Because the very fact that he's refusing to give her the get shows that he has they don't say, well, maybe he used to be a nice guy, but now he's a jerk. This shows that he has a psychological problem. And they admittedly say that they're extending what Rav Moshe says, but it's all based on the theories of Rav Moshe that all these sorts of pre-existing conditions. So that's Rabbi Rachman, Aguda International, exactly. It's been very controversial. It's a little sad in the sense of Rabbi Rachman, who's someone who was if you look in the 1950s, the leading Orthodox rabbis in America were rabbis, let's say, Lukstein and Jung and Rachman. They were the leading rabbis, and he was always on the left a bit, but he was one of the most important rabbis. And towards the end of his life, he now has pretty much become an outcast. His own Orthodox crowd has, but yes, he's an Ish Emes also. This is what he thinks is the truth. So go to their website and you can read all about that. It's a misinterpretation of Rav Moshe. Although I will say one more thing, that these have not been published, and since then he's suffered a lot in terms of his reputation, but Rabbi Mordechai Tendler also annulled marriages. Before he got into all the controversy he convened some sort of Beis Din at YU, and every Thursday night or whatever it was, he was having people come to him, and he was annulling marriages. He wasn't putting it in print. It got to be so controversial, I'm told YU told him they had to stop doing it. And he's the grandson, and he's very involved. So it's not just the Rachman Beis Din, but Tendler wasn't very public about it. Obviously now, because of what's happened with Tendler, all these gittin, I'm sure, all these annulments are now... red flags are raised about them. There's all sorts of questions. So I don't know what to make of all the heterim he gave. And he obviously can't be cited as an authority. But before all this happened, he was doing very similar things to the Rachman based, as the Rachman based and did. So it's interesting in that respect. Okay, anything else? Okay, if not, then, God willing, we will pick up, one more thing, we'll pick up though next week, for the last class. Rabbi Rachman lives in New York now. Just plug him in, Wikipedia or anything. He had a very distinguished career. Was the rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue of Shari Tefila. He then lost the presidency of Yeshiva University to Norman Lamb, a very fateful election. And he then went off to Bar-Ilan, where he became chancellor, and one of them, he's published a number of books, so one of the most important thinkers and writers. He wrote, when the story of American Orthodoxy is written, Immanuel Rackman, he stood up in the 1950s. He battled a Revara and Cutler. He called it Cutlerism. He was the big battler for an open modern Orthodoxy. You said Ravadia. No, we'll get to it next class. Today, his primary, he combines the two. We're going to speak more next class. Primarily, he's a Torah scholar, but he's also involved in politics. I read that a few days ago, Ehud Olmert went to meet him, you know, because they're talking about, you know, what's going to be. Everyone wants to get on board, get the Ravadia's people on board. So he's primarily a Torah scholar. 95% of his day is spent studying Torah and writing tshuvos. So that's him. Any other?
Interesting that, you know, it's not
recorded
when you're
living that much. Yes. And Rav Avadia's son, his son is the chief rabbi of Har Nof, Rav David Yosef. We'll pick up more class. Next class, we'll really get into the meat of who Rav Avadia is, some of his psukim. So until next week, see you then. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a good night, everybody. And I'll hopefully see you one new customer, right? Jonathan will welcome you officially from the barbecue in West Orange, right? That's where we got you online. You can hit the transmit button in the class.
Correct. Direct from the barbecue. I was told about the technology. The speaker, and enjoyed it very much.
Great. All right. We'll see everybody next week. Have a good week. Thanks. Have a good night.